Oh, there's a control somewhere. Oh, here we are, here we are. Probably power? Nope. What did I do? What did I do? So then I'll need the blackboard lights, too, if wherever those are controlled from. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. So, one more thing, chalk. There. Great. There it is. Thank you. So, like a number of other speakers, I'm going to be trying to draw lessons from ADS-CFT. ADS-CFT for these problems of understanding quantum gravity and cosmology. ADS-CFT and its cousins like the matrix theory are our most complete formulation of a theory of quantum gravity, but they still are focused on a certain kind of observation. So if you think of global ADS space as being like a box, what ADS-CFT, or again, their corresponding observables in matrix theory, tell you in the most direct way is the observations of an observer who sort of lives outside and can throw things in from the boundary and then see what comes back out. And you can do quite a lot with this. From this kind of thought experiment, you can conclude that black hole evolution is unitary. You can conclude that for this theory of quantum gravity, Lorentz invariant is exact, at least for that subgroup of the Lorentz group that's preserved by the background. You can try to draw more abstruse conclusions, like the fact that Euclidean wormholes, which have been discussed in the past, don't seem to contribute to the path integral. They would produce non-local effects in time that the gauge theory doesn't have. And actually, these are all conclusions that you can draw just from the existence of the duality without being able to solve the strongly coupled quantum field theory that actually describes gravitational physics. If you imagine further that you have a very powerful computer that would allow you to solve gauge theory, then you can even do things like ask about the S matrix at energies for, say, scattering of gravitons at energies far above the Planck scale. And you would have an algorithm for calculating that S matrix. But again, these are all things that you measure by sitting outside of the space where gravity is happening and throwing stuff in. And actually, this is one reason why the matrix theory and ADS-CFT, work. It's because in quantum gravity, normally, when you talk about local observables, it's very hard to imagine sharply defined observables that would have some nice fundamental description. And ADS space and the corresponding spaces for other dualities have these boundaries where the metric is not fluctuating, and so where it's possible to make sharp observations, even though elsewhere in the space you have strong gravitational physics. But one would like to talk about not just these, I'm not very good with perspective, these X's are supposed to be on the outside of the space, on the boundary of the space. But what you'd like to talk about as much as you can, since in cosmology we don't seem to have these nice places to sit and look, it's not clear that we do, one would like to be able to talk at least to some level of approximation about observables inside the space. And so what I'd like to talk about mostly is an old question of how to construct field operators. In the book, well, this will be the starting point sort of to spin off things, but how to construct field operators inside the space, in the bulk of the space, in terms of operators in the CFT. So the normal dictionary, which I'll review in 1 second, maps operators near the boundary limit of bulk operators into CFT operators. To what extent can one construct field operators in the interior and correspondingly the local Hilbert space in the interior in terms of operators in the CFT? So just for the notation, since I'm talking about global ADS space, X here is really an angular coordinate on, say, the three-sphere directions of the ADS space. And Z is a radial coordinate, which it's convenient that 0 be the boundary. And so the interior, the center, is some finite value like 1 for Z. The value won't matter. Anyway, just so there's the notation. So we want to construct this thing. And I have to say that almost my entire talk consists of pulling together things that many people have said in different places over time. There's relatively little that's new, but I think it's just useful to think about this question and to kind of just review what's known and not known about it. In fact, this question was asked in the early days of ADS-CFT, shortly after Juan's paper, by a number of groups, Banks, Douglas, Horowitz, and Martinick, Balasubramanian, Krauss, Lawrence, Trivedi, Benya, who answered it in the following way. You can use the bulk wave equation to relate the operator in the interior, to the field operators near the interior, to the field operators near the boundary. So you first use the bulk wave equation to do that. And then you use the standard dictionary, which in one form says that the limit as you approach the boundary of the bulk operators appropriately scaled are the boundary operators. And in this way, you then write this in terms of these. Now, actually, this construction is a bit awkward because the boundary of ADS space isn't a Cauchy surface for the interior. So this is not a problem that has a really natural mathematical answer. And in fact, the original papers approached this problem in what in retrospect was a rather awkward way, so awkward that they were able to solve the problem at leading order in large N, where the bulk fields have a term that's linear in the boundary operators, but even at next order in 1 over N, where you get a term which is quadratic in the boundary operators, they were unable to carry the calculation to that next order, and even conjectured that maybe there was some fundamental limitation already showing up on the ability to construct these operators. So one of the things I want to do, actually, is this question has been revisited in recent years by Cabot, Lowe, Lifshitz, and Lowe, and in a series of papers which do a number of things. But what I'd like to do is just to pull out one very simple construction they introduce, which shows very directly how to carry out this construction order by order, at least in 1 over n, as far as you want to go. So let's suppose we have a massive field in the bulk. It could be a metric eventually, let's suppose just we have the simplest thing, a massive field in the bulk, which eventually we'll be interested in interactions as well. So, but let's do the linear problem first. And let's suppose we have some Green's function for this, any Green's function. So if And of course, there's lots of choices for that Green's function, and in terms of the initial conditions and the boundary conditions. And one of the things I'll do in a couple of minutes is to give you various possible choices for that Green's function. But obviously, you can find at least one solution to this equation. And once you have this, you can write this thing you're trying to construct, the bulk operator, as an integral. So you just use the fact that this is a delta function, and this is just an identity. But now you integrate by parts. And when you integrate by parts, when you get all the derivatives over onto phi, you get this nonlinear term. But the first thing you get before you get the nonlinear term is you get some surface terms. So let's maybe regulate things by putting the boundary at z equals epsilon for now, but that doesn't really matter. So you get some kind of surface terms. Partial z this way minus partial z this way, g of x and z, x prime and epsilon, plus order g. Okay, and now to this leading order, you're done because you've related the field in the bulk to the field near the boundary from picking up that surface term, and the field near the boundary, you then have the ADS CFT dictionary. And so you can write this as some, it's not exactly a Green's function, but something, well, I think I got to call it a transfer function, some function. O of x prime, and then plus again order g. So at least to this linear order, you can, given any Green's function in the bulk, construct the bulk field in terms of the boundary operators. Now, yeah. It goes away because phi, you know. Phi, we're quantizing phi with some definite, say, normalizable boundary condition. So the z derivative is just a delta, is just a dimension. Right. Okay. So what might you take for the Green's function? Let's think about now that Green's function and its ambiguities. So, for instance, one choice for the Green's function, which is kind of convenient, is let's put the field in the center of the field in the center of ADS to make things simple. You can find a Green's function whose support is entirely in these wedges. So on the boundary, it ends up being entirely on a strip, sort of in the space-like direction from the point. One way to see this is you can reduce this to a spherical problem, to a 1 plus 1 dimensional problem. And in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you can interchange space and time and integrate radially to solve. So one choice of the Green's function would represent the operator here in terms of some smeared integral over the CFT operators on a strip like this. I should mention, just in passing, that the large bulk of this series of papers involves trying to write this in even more in the most local possible way. They have some construction in which, instead of a strip, they sort of get just a disk on the boundary. But it requires them to go to complex values of the spatial coordinates. And I mentioned I'm not going to use that. I'm not sure how much sense it makes, but I'm not going to use that for anything. I'm just going to, this is sufficient for my purposes. Question. Yes. Yeah, good. That's a good question. What's the relation between this and that? Yeah, I guess you can think about this as a particular way of introducing the state operator mapping.
But then you don't use.
I think there are two questions, right? One is to write the operator acting in the bug, which is
the
driver.
I see them as separate questions.
And then there is another question, which is to construct the state in the interior hyperspace.
I agree.
I think what you're saying is a very natural way to do it.
Well,
because the problem you mentioned in the beginning about not having input for C service
right.
the wrong way,
right.
you would solve by going to the
good
operator state correspondence, which is moving everything to T plus minus infinity.
Good. So let me say something let me move too high towards minus infinity now. Because one way to think about the ambiguities in this Green's function is, at least at the level of free field, what we're talking about here in ADS space, for a given mass, the fields have a definite periodicity. And so you can take any bit of this support and just translate it down by 2 pi, the ADS periodicity, and instead let that integral, instead of writing in terms of field operators here, write it in terms of field operators here, and the usual state operator mapping in some sense may just be a limit of this where you translate the support all the way to minus infinity. But in some sense, I'm not sure, there's actually more ambiguity than this is 2 pi periodicity, but the 2 pi periodicity is sort of the biggest piece of ambiguity one has in the Green's function. And so it shows you, again, the boundary is not a good Cauchy surface, but the problem is overdetermined, not underdetermined. It has more than one solution. Now expressing it in this form, again, for any choice one makes of this initial Green's function G, any choice of this ambiguity, the order G, so we can now add in the order G terms. I should have organized the blackboard better, but up in the first equation for phi of x and z, you can have the above, and now the order G term is plus G integral over the bulk. And then phi squared of x prime z prime g of x prime z prime. And so you can just solve this iteratively. Having obtained the first approximation for phi, you can simply feed that in and develop the local field operator here as a power series in G, and G is effectively 1 over n in ADS units. So you end up with in the end an expansion in terms of operators linear in the boundary fields plus operators quadratic in the boundary fields. So there's no obstacle. Again, this nice packaging that these folks found in terms of the Green's function shows you that there's no obstacle to at least order by order and 1 over n carrying out this construction. And so extending the usual dictionary for the bulk fields near the boundary to a dictionary in the interior. Yes?
Is this technique powerful enough to answer questions about energies of order n to the 1/4?
Good question. So, good. I'm going to try. I hadn't thought about it. So the rest of my talk is trying to ask what this is good for. Now, energies of order n to the 1/4, I thought you were going to say e to the minus n or something, and I was going to say no.
Quarter, that corresponds to ordinary local physics.
Yes, absolutely. So there's no,
that, if you want, as I say, to tell the difference between a chicken and a duck, that's what you have to be able to do.
You can use these to tell the difference between a chicken with spin up and a chicken with spin down.
But not a chicken and a duck with spin up.
This
would not be powerful enough to get to.
It is powerful enough to get to that kind of resolution. This is not horizon scale. This is not ADS scale resolution. It gets down to
order
six
one in
scales.
Microscopic units.
Order
one in the string books.
Well, you would need to generalize this to perturbative string diagrams.
This discussion, not order one string units, just because. I'm working in the supergravity. There should be some. To get string units, you would need to use some, as you said, some stringy generalization of this. But to order 100 in string units, some fixed physical scale.
Fixed microscopic scale.
So I would be worried if you could construct these operators on an entire space-like slice and show that they commuted. Because that would be sort of too many degrees of freedom.
Right. Now there's several questions here. One is, this is order by one over n. You know, one doubts that one can really do this at finite n for a number of reasons. At finite n, you have big you have to think about big fluctuations of the metric. You know, that's an e to the minus n effect. But if the metric is fluctuating, so you don't even know what x is.
But it looks like you might be able to see it here because X has a time-like direction in field theory, so those O's are not space-like separated.
So now there's an issue. These observables have to be at some level approximate, and the construction is an approximate one. They have to be approximate because observables in the bulk of gravity are always approximate, as far as we know. And so the approximations are, again, big fluctuations of the metric, what do you do? But also, ultimately, we think that there's a fundamental breakdown of locality due to complementarity, which this can't capture. This is working in a limit where you don't see that. Now, having said that, I mean, these operators will, as constructed, well, I want to say they're going to commute at space-like separation. That's not exactly right, because in the theory of gravity, it's like Coulomb gate. You know, things don't commute space-like separation. They have specific non-tails on their commutators, but these things will have the right commutators for a low-energy gauge-fixed theory of gravity. Yeah. Just by construction, of the right commutators. I want to use these operators to measure things, but first. This construction, in the end, it's smeared in time, and you'd like to refer it back to the Hilbert space at a single time. Which you can do, because once you have things in the CFT, I'm imagining for the purpose of this talk that The field theory is something we can regard as exact. We have in principle an exact solution. The field theory, either numerical or we simply know what a quantum field theory is. And so once we have the field operators in this region, we can evolve them, say, forward and back in time and express them all in terms of the operators on some fixed space-like slice, and then just think of these as operators in a fixed single-time Hilbert space. Of course, these are all local operators, things like trace of F squared. And if I start with a local operator at this time, well, the fields are individually going to sort of propagate outwards, and so this is going to, at the very least, become something non-local at a later time. And it's gauge invariant, so these non-local operators have to be tied together by Wilson lines, and also there's nonlinear terms in the field equation, so the Wilson line. This is going to be some kind of non-local gauge invariant operator, and we tend to call any non-local gauge invariant operator a Wilson line. So if we refer all of these all of these operators back to the single time, what you've expressed then is the bulk operator in terms of some superposition of Wilson loop operators acting on this single time Hilbert space. Yes? Multi-traces too. Yeah, multi-traces too. Absolutely, absolutely. It's not clear that Wilson lines are necessarily the only or the best basis for these operators. One puzzle here is that in the end you've expressed this local field operator in terms of Wilson lines in the boundary. And the claim of this construction then is by acting with such Wilson lines at the single time, you instantaneously create somewhere in the center of the space a quantum. And again, that's not surprising that that should be possible, because although the dictionary for ADS-CFT is simplest at the boundary, the duality, the whole Hilbert space of the bulk is contained in the boundary, and so there should be some way to construct at any given time these states. These operators that create and destroy states in the interior, these are historically known as precursors. And one puzzle is that we know from Lon that what a Wilson loop operator does is it creates a string near the boundary. It creates a long string near the boundary. It doesn't create some local operator far away in the bulk. And so there's something missing in this chain of logic. Under what conditions does a Wilson loop construct a string near the boundary? And under what conditions does a Wilson loop construct a quantum far away from the boundary? This has never been answered. This seems to me like it's something that should have, a sharp answer, that it must not be a Wilson loop per se, but a sufficiently wild superposition of Wilson loops that we no longer think of it really as a Wilson loop. And there may be some better way to. Face light, yeah. It could, but I think you want that this operator commute. But still, if you ask what does it do to the Hilbert space, is it that simple? Right.
It's the same question at the level of particles.
Right.
The trajectory that ends on the boundary.
Right. But here you have the fact that this operator at this time, this operator, it's at different times. You could be right, but I
the operator always.
If you just act with a single Wilson loop, you're going to make a big splash of
string.
Of string and energy, and it's a monster. It's
right. And so I don't think you can think of a particle. Maybe this is a manifestation of complementarity, that there's some way to think of a particle here as being a superposition of many kinds of string out
very
here.
Very complicated.
Right. Yeah. But at the level of the operator dictionaries, I think you're really creating string states near the boundary.
So this is all supersymmetric, so you can't get them to sort of cancel each other locally by being oppositely oriented?
Maybe there's some kind of cancellation. Yeah. I had a crazy conjecture that was too simple and wrong, but I'll mention it. What you get most directly in ADS-CFT duality, as Lon showed, is these BPS Wilson loops that couple both to the Higgs field and the gauge field. And there's also the Wilson loops that don't couple to the Higgs field. And so I had a conjecture for a few days that those actually create states in the interior. But as we realized and then found out that Lon had already shown, the Wilson loops that are not BPS that don't couple to the Higgs field also produce states at the boundary. They just produce a certain superposition of the other kind of states. But, I throw this out there. There may be some way to characterize the operators that actually act in the interior and don't produce anything near the boundary. So what can you do with these operators? Here's a thought experiment which is due to Brun Hubney and also to Sacchino and Suskin in various forms. So imagine that you throw a couple of particles in from the boundary. In the interior, they get close to each other, and there's some quantum event. They either they collide and either go in this direction or this direction. So you get some superposition of two states, or many states, but there's two states. And now you want to ask, you know, can you, by measurements in the CFT at more or less the same time, not waiting for the products to come out, can you measure the outcome of this quantum event? And you can, because again, these operators that we've constructed, create and destroy exactly these quanta, and so you can ask what state you have. Yes, I'll come back to this in a second. I have two things to say. Let me say that one first. So to do this measurement, so there's an interesting distinction. And again, this distinction was made sharp. Again, another thing coming from the quantum information folks, Daniel Gottesman and John and a couple collaborators pointed out that if you are an ordinary local person in the CFT, restricted to the kind of local measurements that we can make in our CFT, in our quantum field theory, you can't measure these Wilson loops. At least, I'm not sure, maybe over a long time, so even over a long time, it's hard, but you can't measure these Wilson loops. And so if you're a person who lives in this CFT in the sense that we live in QCD, you can't make these interior measurements. You can only measure things near the boundary. But if you're a meta observer who has access to this entire wave function and can measure any Hermitian operator, then you can measure all the way into the bulk. In some sense, the causal structure of the boundary theory here is a bit of a red herring, I think, because if you think of matrix theory, the VFSS theory, there is no causal structure to the dual theory. The dual theory is just quantum mechanics, and all operators are just traces of products of matrices, and there's no restriction. There's no natural causality restriction on measuring these. So it's an interesting fact that in this case, there are these two kinds of rules you could make, one of which lets you do this measurement, one not. But the one that lets you make this measurement is really the more natural one, I think, for this purpose. Okay. So Huibniz's elaboration of this experiment is the following. So you throw these in, and you can actually make the measurement immediately afterwards. You know, again, you have a time slice that does this. And so you can throw these in. You can make the measurement of what happens on that slice immediately afterwards. And then you can throw in a shell of matter. And the shell of matter makes a horizon so that the, and ultimately a singularity, so that this quantum event that you're measuring is happening behind the horizon. Now, if you don't throw in the shell, you can actually check your measurement by waiting till these things come out and make the same measurement again, and you've measured it correctly. Once you throw the shell in, you no longer have that option. But the fact that you could have done this tells you that you've made, you know, makes you believe that you've made a correct measurement of something behind the horizon. So it drives home the fact, which again, many, many people have said, but it's nice to have sort of a realization of it, that even when you have black holes and horizons, the Hilbert space behind the horizon is still lives within, in some way, the Hilbert space of the dual field theory. So let me try to draw a so. Everybody else is drawing hats and things. So I mean, if you have, right, what you've done is so we'll come back to this, but now I mean, in some sense, the flavor of this construction, well, it's not so much. Well, the flavor of this construction is that you run things backwards in the bulk and then forwards in the boundary to express them as boundary operators. But here's this is also your thought experiment. Here's something where you don't know when you throw these particles in which of these two final states you're going to get. It's a genuine quantum superposition, and so the fact that you can measure it is more than at least classically you think you have just by knowing what you threw in. it really means that you ask you, well, you it really means that, that you can resolve this into the different states you would get by the you can change its state. Well, you're right. You can change its state instantaneously. You have access to the whole Hilbert space, so you can instantaneously change the state from any state to any other state. You know, you can immediately create you with all your memories and the belief that you've actually, you know, lived. But you have access to the full Hilbert space. There's the basic point is locality is completely irrelevant. You can do the same thing here that you could do if this was a quantum system that you had complete causal access to in the usual sense. So I'm talking right. Good. So I'm talking about probes which are sort of local quantum fields. You can also talk about probes which are brains, and so you think of as being identified with eigenvalues in the field theory, and say many of the same things. I don't want to go into this in too much detail, except that I resist calling the probes eigenvalues because a probe like a D3 brain that sits here, we tend to think of as being an eigenvalue sitting here. And that's true over some very, very long time average observation. But if you look at it instantaneously, all the eigenvalues due to quantum effects are of order the entire UV scale. And so calling the probe position an eigenvalue doesn't really oversimplifies. You have to say more about how you identify the probe degrees of freedom in the large Hilbert space of the CFT. And probably you can do everything. I think probably the probe story in the end is very analogous to the story with supergravity quanta. Okay, how much time? 10 minutes is perfect. So since all the cool people are drawing hats and stuff, I'll try to draw some. Okay, so this is everything I know about cosmology, which is that it's more or less it's all there is. Yeah, you take ADS space and you turn it on its side, and you make the boundaries kind of rougher. And now there's a question which kind of underlies some of these questions, which is if I have a field operator over here, some approximate local observable. Can I construct it in terms of this very large Hilbert space over here in that cap? And you can actually, use the same Green's function construction. And the most obvious Green's function is one that would, be non-zero only in this forward direction and would allow you to construct this field operator in the same sense we've been discussing in terms of observations made in the obvious place, at all of the future points to which any information might escape from that point. Now, in the case of ADS space, there's this feature or bug that you can change the support of where you look due to the 2 pi periodicity of the fields, but more generally just due to the fact that you have a time evolution operator that allows you to relate fields here to fields here. And if you try to ask what would it mean over here to have the corresponding thing, to be able to move the support of where you look from here to here, or maybe even to, well, first let's say moving it to here, something like that, and then ultimately moving it to here. At the first step, you need, so in order to have a good time evolution in ADS space, you need a boundary condition. The boundary condition, the usual one, is that the non-normalizable modes are zero. The analogous thing here is you would need a boundary condition. So, what the nature of the boundary condition is, you would need some kind of final state condition along the way. For example, in these caps, you would need some condition that relates, roughly speaking, the state of the right-moving particles to the state of the left-moving particles. And if you had that kind of final state boundary condition, you would sort of have enough information to move these observations over to here, and then maybe using the Wilson loop-like evolution, move them to some other place, like maybe here, where you might like. Is this a plausible thing? This is what you need to do what you might like to do, which is to construct the entire Hilbert space in terms of one smaller region. Is you need some kind of funny boundary condition, both in the past and in the future, for the modes. Okay, so I'm just about done. I'm going to spend, I think I only have about 5 minutes, and I'll use them. So now. My conclusion is that you can do this if you impose a final state boundary. Well, roughly speaking, you can't do it if you don't impose some kind of final state boundary condition in the caps that you don't care about. Yes. Yeah. It's not clear. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Because you have, in some sense, you have to be able to capture all of the information that comes out of this point. Now, I should say. I'm trying here to take these lessons and extend them to that state.
Yeah.
Now, it's not clear that this is how holography has to work. It's not clear that to represent these fields in terms of this Hilbert space, it has to follow the same construction as it does when you turn spaces on the side. But if you simply want to ask kind of the level of differential equations, do you have enough information to relate the field here to the fields here? You need to fix what they're doing everywhere in.
You get the Schwarzschild black hole, genuine Schwarzschild black hole with asymptotic meet flat boundary conditions.
Do you need? You're asking. Well, so good. So the short good. So I mean, I'm not sure if this is what you're asking, but let me draw this picture because it relates to what I actually wanted to say. So if you imagine some kind of black hole in ADS space.
No, I mean in flat space.
Or in ADS. But the same construction. So the same. I'm not sure if this is your question, but this is the question that you might have asked. We already talked about behind.
Only when I hear the answer.
We already talked about behind the horizon in the sense of that thought experiment. And again, there is some Green's function which allows you to write the field here in terms of the fields here. And yes, in Schwarzschild space, it will allow you to write the field here in terms of fields. I haven't thought about this hard, but in terms of some kind of boundary fields, right? Yeah, I actually haven't thought about the Schwarzschild case hard enough, but I presume the path light cone. Yeah. So I refuse to think about eternal black holes.
Yeah.
It cuts down the number of papers you need to read. So let me just say a few limitations. One limitation is the following. So we can construct field operators. So can we therefore think about using this construction to measure the curvature near the singularity in terms of some operator in the CFT? And it seems like I'm saying yes, but the construction, of course, is that you take the field equation in the bulk and you evolve it backwards to the boundary, and then you evaluate the expectation value of that evolved thing. And I think we would all agree that I haven't measured the curvature there, I've calculated it. This is the quantum problem seems like a genuine measurement. You really reduce the state, you've correlated it with your apparatus. But this is unquestionably a calculation. And so, for example, if Samir Mather comes along and says, no, this is wrong because you left out some piece of bulk physics, well, you can't disagree with him based on arguments in the gauge theory, because part of this construction assumes that you have perfect control of both the boundary and the bulk. And that's unsatisfying. You would like the boundary theory to be smart enough to solve the bulk for you, to do all the work for you. You shouldn't have to do any work. And here you have to do half the work, and it's very hard work. In fact, I don't have enough time to go into this in detail, and I'm not sure I really have much to say, but it's well known that evolving backwards in a black hole geometry is a very dangerous thing to do. In Hawking's original calculation of the Hawking radiation, there are all of these energies of order e to the m squared times the Planck scale. And he knew, I don't know how he knew, that that was irrelevant, that he wasn't really doing transplanckian physics. And the argument for that is this nice slice argument that if you take a state and evolve it forwards in time, you only hit nice low-energy physics. But if you take some given state on this slice, not the one you got by forward evolution, and try to evolve it backwards, which is what this construction requires you to do, you generically encounter energies of this order. So in order to carry out this construction, you need to be able to do quantum gravity calculations directly in the bulk. You're not letting the boundary can't do it for you. You've got to do it. And so the whole construction tells you. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Things forward.
Right.
There's presumably a nice, in this isolated laboratory,
right.
A nice unitary estimate.
Right. Yes.
Why can't you run it backwards?
Because in the laboratory, you produce this state. You then want to make a measurement.
Sorry.
If you want to make a measurement from the if in the laboratory you have this state, you then want to ask from the point of view of the boundary theory, do I have A or do I have B? To ask that question, you have to evolve them back separately, and then you run into this problem that states, generic states, don't have a good backward evolution.
Can I run the superposition of them back?
You can run the superposition back. Yes, you can. But if you try to run the individual ones back, you
produce. Well, maybe we should pick this up later.
Yeah.
I think you're.
Sounds like you could send in a. But what you're saying is that you also want to know the states of the Hawking.
One of these teleportation things to measure interest.
If you evolve them backwards in the nice slices, right?
Yes.
You're going to get some reasonable state.
No, because remember, the nice slice of the property, there's a red shift, and then when you're back, it's a blue shift. And what's going to happen is a generic state as you run backwards is going to have quanta that run into the infalling star at constant energy.
I'm saying it's true for the Hawking radiation, but I'm
you don't think it's true. You don't think it's true. You think it's only true for the Hawking radiation and not for other states?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe you're right, but I'm surprised. But I mean, why should that be? Why is that true? I believe you. If you come, I mean, I'd like. Is that true?
Well, because somehow, I mean, there is a small amount of time. I mean, there's nice slices. This is they're not getting stretched too much when you evolve.
Right. You said good. Okay, so
they're getting stretched a lot when you go out to infinity.
That's right.
But if this measurement is made when the black hole is already gone for half of its lifetime, there's a lot of stretching in the past from these modes.
But if you try to get too far up close to the singularity, it's
possible. Now, you're right. Maybe this affects only. Maybe I'm wrong about where it is. Maybe this affects only a tiny piece of the wave function that's aimed in just the right direction.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe this is not a problem. Good.
Okay. Well, that's good because I was thinking I'm going to have to rewrite my talk.
Okay. But even if you can't. Well, good, that's good. So you can do the calculation to high accuracy if in fact it's only high. Very precisely aimed states. Good. In any case, it tells you that in principle, this Hilbert space is in the big Hilbert space. What we'd like is some way to look at this Hilbert space, the boundary Hilbert space, the CFT Hilbert space directly, and know how to identify in that Hilbert space the degrees of freedom that are just from some intrinsic information here without having to go through knowing what the bulk theory is, identify the degrees of freedom that correspond to local physics in the bulk.
I think the eigenvalues do that. I would debate that.
I disagree because they're not eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are all of order the UV cutoff.
No, they're not. The the brain probes are decoupled to a very good approximation.
But you're using bulk information there. You're using bulk information there. You don't actually know what those probes are in the language of the. Well,
I think, yeah,
right. Maybe. And maybe so there's a suggestion from Lenny, which is again maybe sufficient, which is you have the boundary at one time, even with a black hole there, say you have some space-like slice and some space-like slice at another time, and now you want to suppose there's some set of operators in the CFT that correspond to local operators here, and some set of operators in this CFT that correspond to local operators here. And one certainly necessary condition is that if you take the time derivative of these operators, they satisfy some local evolution law. And that might be enough information. It may be that that's a sufficiently special property. It's not clear. To say that you've identified some set of operators in this theory which are parameterized by positions along some space-like slice and which evolve locally. In time, not sure. Anyway, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
The statement that you want to impose some future boundary conditions in your inflating universe. In fact, there's this recent paper of Aninos Strominger and someone else who actually made a proposal for a future boundary condition that I think does precisely what you want.
I think you're right. So I should have mentioned that. Along the de Sitter parts, they have some kind of Beerstein condition.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
That's the strength of boundary condition that you need to make this
level. It's like a reflecting boundary condition, and it says that instead of measuring your original operator, you can measure its reflection, or you've reflected it off of the boundary.
Right.
That does precisely what you
want. That's what you need. That's what you need.
But how to do it in a fractal...
If you impose a boundary condition where you have a uniform metric, you don't have the fractal universe.
Right.
It's precisely forbidden the fractal universe. I mean, you could add them up by saying you have this and then you have bubbles.
I mean, couldn't you just declare that you don't want any flux of energy through Scribe Plus or through the fractal version of Scribe Plus?
Not a flux of energy.
I mean, that's morally the boundary condition that they proposed.
It's hard to make it a local condition in the cast.
I think morally is that they are forbidden the fractal because the structure that you get out of ordinary perturbative theory is just the metric which has a lot of fluctuations.
Right.
But I want to consider the amplitude to produce no fluctuations. So I get a fixed boundary condition, and that removes the fractal.
So the boundary
is the perturbative fractal. I think. Talking about this picture or talking about the small waves is essentially the same thing. I mean, one is a bigger fractal than the other, but
that's not what the Sitter space does, though,
right? Does.
Pardon?
Yeah. I'm also coming back to this picture. So in that case, you have the two hats or maybe more hats.
Yes.
So this, and the idea is that the entanglement between the state and the different hats has to disappear because each hat has all the information. Is that correct?
You need a final state boundary condition to project to produce that entanglement. Right.
But then, does it correspond to doing a measurement to know in which hat you are?
I don't know. One problem is, well, this is a classical picture of a very quantum state. I mean, I like this idea. I think I said the earlier discussion, the proposal is that you impose boundary conditions that give you only one hat. Is that one way to interpret the?
It would be very boring because you couldn't ask any questions about the kind that you want to ask about the typical behavior.
Typical behavior. You say there's only one hat.
Yeah, trying to kill bubbles
But then wouldn't then the state go into a superposition of states corresponding to each hat? The different hats are different. A linear terms in your state.
Well,
is that correct?
I mean, the fundamental is sort of something you decide on. In effect, you're taking this big wave. Classically, you're taking this big Harlan wave function, you're projecting it onto some chosen some metric of your choice.
Right.
That's something you can do. But another thing you may want to do is just to calculate expectation values and probabilities.
And you want to calculate more inclusive probabilities.
More inclusive, exactly.
Right.
I thought part of the point of Ben's talk yesterday was that you always can restrict yourself to just one observer and one hat.
That's a restriction. That's a restriction of the kind of question you ask. You ask questions that refer to only one hat, or ask questions that refer to
so I think let's continue the discussion in the coffee break. We have 40 minutes now for the coffee.